Breakfast Hour of the Jason Rancho, brought to you by Robbins & Company Structural Moving and Foundation Repair. Lots of news happening all around the world and right here at home. Producer Darren, let's find out what's trending.
What's trending? Let's get political.
So last night's debate was a lot different than the Susan Hutchison, Maria Cantwell debate. Last night's debate was between Dino Rossi and Kim Schreier, both trying to take over for Congressman Dave Reichert, who is retiring at the end of this term. Now, it's an interesting district, Washington's 8th, because it's a lot of land. It's a lot on the west and the eastern side of the state. I mean, we're talking about a district that includes Sammamish, Issaquah, Buckley, Covington, as well as Cle Elum and Ellensburg. And there are a lot of very specific issues that impact this district that don't really impact a lot of others. And so a lot of people are paying attention to the changing demographics. They notice that under Dave Reichert, you don't really have a whole bunch of hardcore Republicans living in the district, that it's more a purple district. Dave Reichert, incredibly well-liked, huge high name recognition because of the work that he did as the sheriff. And just because he won and is a Republican doesn't mean that this is an easy get for Republicans. This is going to be a tough race for Dino Rossi. Now, right now, all signs are looking good for Dino Rossi. All signs are looking good. Polling indicates that he's up. There appears to be a post-Kavanaugh bump that he's enjoying, on top of the fact that he's actually someone who understands the district, whereas Dr. Kim Schreier doesn't really belong, principally, to represent the 8th District. She is a hardcore Seattle progressive. She is a member of the resistance movement. And there was a moment last night during the debate where she basically acknowledged that. Do you think someone who is a member of the resistance is going to serve the unique needs of Washington's 8th? Do you think someone who marches along and protests just about everything has the principles of someone living right now in Sammamish or Auburn? Do you think someone like that is going to understand the issues of farmers in the district, the agricultural industry? Do you think someone like that is going to give more cachet to the district or less? Because if you get someone like a Kim Schreier in office, what is she going to focus on? The craziness, the banning guns, Medicare for all, which will bankrupt Medicare. She'll be pushing this idea of impeaching the president, impeaching Brett Kavanaugh. And while she does that and becomes more and more and more far to the left, drifting even further than you would normally expect, do you think that people in D.C., do you think congresspeople within the Democratic Party even, are going to work with her to address some of the issues that are important to you right now? I would say no, which is why this is such an important race. It is such an important race. And there were moments last night, it kind of felt like Kim Schreier didn't know what she was talking about, didn't really understand the district. And on the economy, both candidates were simply asked, okay, what's the biggest issue facing the economy? Here's Dino Rossi's answer. Let's listen to him and then compare it to what Kim Schreier says.
I say the biggest challenge to our economy is people not understanding what makes the economy work. What you need for businesses to grow and for people to have jobs is you need modest taxation and fair and predictable regulation that let entrepreneurs go be entrepreneurs. My opponent wants to raise people's taxes by $2,821, a very family in the 8th Congressional District. Actually, pulling money out of people's back pockets isn't going to make it better. My opponent wants to double income taxes by actually having a government take over health care. My opponent supports a 57 cent a gallon gas tax that won't go to roads or congestion relief. My opponent also supports a state income tax. All these things, they don't create jobs. What you want to have is these small businesses growing. When they grow, they have to hire people. When they hire people, people have a chance to get a better job, and they get moved forward. And when there's a competition for employment, people's salaries go up, people's benefits go up. That's what you want. That's what you have to do.
Dino Rossi spoke with confidence, with clarity, and with vision. But then when Kim Schreier was asked about the threat of automation basically robots taking over lots of jobs. Here was her answer.
Well, we're not there yet, and I do see that as a possibly upcoming threat. You know, when we get there, I think we can talk about things like a universal basic income, but we're not there yet. And we still need people to run those machines and to do the programming for that machinery. So my eye is on that. But fortunately, we have not come to that place quite yet. Thank you.
She would always end her statements with thank you, which was her code of saying, I have nothing to add. Please don't ask me a follow up. I don't know what I'm doing. And just think about that answer on something that's so incredibly important to folks who are in many industries that are facing job cuts due to automation. She doesn't have a plan for the future. She has none. Well, when we get there, we'll get there, and then I'll come up with a plan. So you're telling me when we get to the point where people already are losing their jobs, that's when you're going to start with your plan? How about you plan ahead of that? How about you say, you know what, this is an incredible threat, and we need to be focused on education. We need to be focused specifically on getting job training programs that I'm going to work my tail off to get funding for. No, when we get there, we're going to get there. That's who you want to represent you in Congress. That is scary. That's a scary place to be. Kim Schreier is so out of her league. And Dino Rossi is such a clear choice. I cannot imagine anyone watched that debate last night, listened live to that debate last night right here on KTTH, and said anything different. In fact, we've got a couple of polls going on. I've got a poll on my Instagram feed, but also the Facebook page, facebook.com/JasonRantzShow. I just simply ask, who did better? Who won the debate last night, Dino Rossi or Kim Schreier? The one on my page was like 93% Dino, 7% Kim Schreier. On the KTTH Facebook page, let's go to it right now, it's 99% Dino Rossi, 1% Kim Schreier. And that's with like a lot of votes. Doesn't, not boding well for Kim Schreier. You're listening to the Jason Rantz Show. Welcome back to the Jason Rantz Show on AM 770 KTTH, streaming live on the KTTH smartphone app. Despite the city of Seattle's best efforts to keep public documents private, a judge said a pollster has to turn over polling data that they show to the council members and the mayor's office. On top of that, they've got to provide any identified council members' private communication around the head tax vote. The lawyer suing the city of Seattle is Lincoln Beauregard of the Connolly Law Offices, and he joins me live this morning. Lincoln, good morning.
Hey, Jason, thanks for having me on, sir.
So what specifically do you hope to get by tomorrow, and why is it important to your claims against the city? The basic claims being that they violated the Open Public Meetings Act.
Well, what we hope to get is basically some information that reveals what's going on at the Seattle's basically shadow city hall. What we've learned through this process, and it's not just mainly not really about the head tax, it's more about transparency, is that basically the city of Seattle politicians are run by a shadow city hall. It's called EMC Research, and it's owned and operated basically by payments from the unions and altruistic billionaire. So what we want to find out is what they're doing at this secret city hall. And it would include, hopefully, information about strategies on politics and what have you. And I could go on at length, but I want to make sure I'm answering your questions.
Well, and this really centers around how the council and the mayor's office dealt with the aftermath of passing the job-killing Amazon head tax. And it appears that they found polling that was detrimental to their future political careers. And in private, they decided to negotiate to get rid of the head tax. And that, you allege, is against the Open Public Meetings Act.
Yeah, that's exactly correct. And the significance is they did it all in private at a private company on a weekend. It's called EMC Research. And so what the judge ruled is that the EMC Research company has to pass over the briefings and the information that these politicians used in private over a weekend at what I would call a shadow city hall.
Yeah.
And they decided that they actually have to hand it over so that we can see where they're really legislating, because all these elective officials have been forced to admit that they are reacting to the information that was provided by this organization. But then they come into the real city hall and act like that's where they decided to do what they were going to do. But it's not true.
So there's going to be someone who's listening right now in Everett or Sammamish or Tacoma or Bellevue, and they're saying, okay, this is a Seattle issue. Why should I care? But it extends beyond Seattle, the principles here.
Yeah, it's all about government transparency. And what we see here is that the Seattle elected officials, who have some of the best resources, have no idea that you can't just have secret meetings out of the public view and then vote on them in public in kind of a showmanship type of a presentation. And I think this is happening all throughout the region. It's something that, you know, that's one of the reasons we're bringing the case, that if you're in Everett, if you're anywhere in this region, you should know that this seems to be the standard practice, that your politicians could sit back and decide over a weekend to tax your dog or your cat, not tell you why they did it or how they did it, could be run by a special interest, and then you could wake up in the morning and find out that, wow, you're being taxed.
Yeah. And, you know, just from a media perspective, half the stories that I cover at KTTH.com and on the show happen because I'm able to find out about them through public document requests, because they do so many things in private. By the way, if you're just joining me, I'm talking with Lincoln Beauregard of the Connolly Law Offices. He's suing the city of Seattle over violating an Open Public Meetings Act on behalf of his client, James Egan, who's also been on the show in the past. The judge yesterday also said that the council and their staff, they have to go through their personal inboxes, their personal cell phones, to see if they have any details or data, emails, whatever, that need to be turned over. This is particularly important because, as we know, Councilmember Sally Backshaw, just a reminder to everybody, she was doing things, city business, on personal email accounts, a personal email account where that email was deleted. And I was able to find out about it through a constituent, but it wasn't turned over. So there's lots of stuff that's out there that doesn't get properly disseminated.
Yeah, I think that's right. And some of the evidence we put in front of the judge that we thought was persuasive was that we actually have Jenny Durkin, the mayor of Seattle's cell phone records for her official phone. And one thing that was startling to us is that she didn't use her official phone for the 6 days leading up to the legislative action that we're talking about. But we know she used her private cell phone because we've got little snippets of what was on that. So kind of like Hillary Clinton's emails, what you have is, suspiciously Jenny Durkin not using her official phone for the entire time that they're at this basically what I would call shadow city hall over a weekend, deciding what they're going to do in legislation that could drive the richest company in the world out of our region. And that's the kind of stuff that the public has a right to watch.
They absolutely do. But here's a question for you, because I struggle to sort of figure this out myself. When I put in FOIA requests, Freedom of Information requests, saying I want all the emails that have to do with city business that were sent from council members' personal email inboxes, I have no idea if I'm being given all that's there. So how do you know you're going to get all the information that you're supposed to be getting?
Well, from a litigation standpoint, what happens is, and everybody listening to this should know, is that when you send an email, somebody gets it. And when everybody's told to hand over their stuff and you're the one that doesn't do it, I'm going to find you and I'm going to show it to the court that you didn't comply. So that's one of the best ways. And I have extra tools that sometimes the media doesn't. And the extra tools come in the form of subpoenas and depositions. I can go down and say, Jenny Durkin, why did you not send me this email that somebody else received? So that's one of the benefits of being a litigator and doing open government cases.
That's a little bit of a humble brag right there. He's got tools that I don't have. When you get the email, when you get this polling data, then what? What's next?
Well, basically, what we want to do is evaluate its relevance to the lawsuit, but some of that's already clear because, like, for example, Lorena Gonzalez talked about that 60% of the public was against them. And we want to use it to show that basically what these politicians are doing is they're walking down to the shadow city hall, the private city hall of EMC Research, getting briefed and told marching instructions by private special interest entities, and then coming up and violating the law because they don't care about the citizens, they care about their special interest groups.
You made a claim on Facebook and Twitter this week having to do about misconduct of a judge in a separate case. Before we let you go, can you explain those allegations?
Yeah, what it is that last year I was the one that was responsible for basically taking down the mayor, and that wasn't our goal to start out. There was a big political fight related to that, and they asked me to be sanctioned for something that was pretty mundane. And this is something that I suspected from people in the media but got confirmed by a public records request, is that this particular judge, Judge Veronica Galban, the day before she brought me in and sanctioned me in front of the media and basically took the wind out of our sails to try and take a pedophile out of office, she actually sat back, invited the media back into her jury room out of public view, and had some sort of briefing with them about how they're going to engage in the courtroom. Now, wow. The significance of that is the Code of Judicial Conduct says you're supposed to tell the parties when you're going to actually have a meeting with anybody. But to call the members of the media back, and she actually added people she liked, like Univision, to the list of media members and call them into the private jury room in a high-profile case, not tell the parties, and then bring out the lead attorney challenging the sitting mayor, who is a pedophile, and sanction him $5,000 for filing documents in the court file so that members of the media could read on that's the argument, is, to me, very concerning. And there's actually a code of judicial conduct that says that's not supposed to happen. Now, Jason, something else I'll add to that just real quickly is that, you know, for me, I don't know if it's that she's good friends with Lorena Gonzalez had anything to do with it. I don't know that. Lorena Gonzalez, who ascended under Ed Murray. I don't know if it's the fact that she's good friends with Fee Lopez, who's head of the Community Police Commission, who was appointed by Ed Murray. I don't know if that had anything to do with it. But you can see, if you're me and you're fighting this powerful force, and you're up against this judge, it's very concerning. And then she does things like invalidate the initiative on safe injection sites and take that away from the voting public, and she's friends with these people. And it just bothers me, and I want to know more truth about that.
And so are you filing any sort of claim against the judge, a complaint?
I don't want to speculate on that on the radio, because I want to make sure that anything I do is fully merited and deliberate and only for the public good. But it's something we're heavily investigating, and, you know, I'm also evaluating the need for a political action committee.
There you go. Well, we wish you the best of luck in all of that, and certainly whatever you find out, please let us know. But more importantly, once you get the documents on Friday, you've got our show email address. You should forward all that stuff over if you're allowed to. I've been talking with Lincoln go ahead.
Well, yeah, we'll be sure to send it over, Jason. I can't promise you it'll be on Friday, because the EMC research, the shadow city hall, they're actually still trying to fight it and go to the higher courts, but it probably won't work.
Well, hopefully it won't, because we have the right to actually access this information. Lincoln Beauregard of Connolly Law Offices, thank you for joining us live this morning. Appreciate it.
Thank you, sir.
You're listening to the Jason Rand Show live in the Online Trading Academy studio. 1-800-465-8770 for your text messages. AM 770 KTTH and 94.5 FM on the Greater East Side. A new tiny home village is set to open in the heart of South Lake Union in Seattle. One that has some neighbors concerned about safety. In fact, I'm one of them. The encampment will be managed by the Low Income Housing Institute, Lehigh. And to help us figure out exactly what the plan entails to ensure that the neighborhood crime doesn't spike is Josh Castle. He is Lehigh's Director of Community Engagement. Josh, good morning.
Good morning.
So in an interview, I believe it was Cairo 7, it might have been Como News, you said safety is going to be the number one priority at this tiny home encampment. How so? What's the plan?
Sure. So the tiny house village in South Lake Union will have a 24/7 security, and each of the residents that will be moving there are going to sign a code of conduct. They're going to have to agree to that and abide by it. And the code of conduct includes things such as no disrupting of neighbors or just village harmony in general. And, you know, obviously, you know, no violence or theft or any of those things. And then they are also required to do a certain amount of chores and community activities. So we want all the residents that are there to, you know, to of course, to understand that and then be part of making sure the village is successful and that it's running smoothly. And so between the security that we're having, the on-site staff, and then I should also mention we have several case managers that will be helping as well.
Yeah. That's okay.
With the residents to help them with housing, employment, education, healthcare,
so
all rental services.
Let's talk just briefly about
all those things. We expect that, you know, we're going to have a peaceful village.
Yeah, and look, I hope that the village is going to be peaceful. I have some questions about the security. For example, are they armed security? When we say security, are we talking about off-duty police officers? What does that entail?
Sure, it's going to be Lehigh staff that are there around the clock, and they will be running, you know, the security booth that we have that will be right there at the front.
Mm-hmm.
And they will be people have to sign in. Anybody who comes in and out will have to sign in, and they'll have to make sure that they are you know, legit, of course, before they enter the village. And there's only one way to enter and exit.
Are they trained security staff, or they're just staffers?
They'll be doing perimeter checks, you know.
Josh, are they trained security members, or are they just staff members who are put in that position?
They're staff members that are specifically, they're actually called village organizers.
Okay.
And they're also doing security and management of the village.
So it's not security staff.
Well, it's both security and management of the village. But they're there. We basically have a house that is devoted to security. That's right there at the front for people to sign in. And they monitor everything going on at the front. And, you know, they monitor everything going around the village.
Do they have means of personal protection?
I guess, do you want to ask a specific question on that?
Do they have anything on them, whether it's like pepper spray or a gun or a baton or something? Just, you know, if the intent is to...
Well, they're not going to be like police, you know?
Yeah.
They won't have something like that. But I will say that our experience with, you know, the other villages, like we opened True Hope Village in early September, and then Whittier Heights Village several months before that. And the security staff there and the case management staff, you know, have, you know, reported to us, and I go and visit the villages personally several times. The villages are peaceful, and everything is going well. And there are not, you know, the issues that, you know, that some people mentioned have happened at, you know, previous villages. That's just not the case for these ones. I don't visualize there being a need for something like, you know, arming people or anything.
If you're just joining me, I'm talking with Josh Castle. He is Lehi's Director of Community Engagement. Lehi is the Low-Income Housing Institute. They're the ones who are managing this new tiny home encampment in the South Lake Union neighborhood. And we're talking about security and safety one of the tents that are encampments that you did not mention is Licton Springs, a neighborhood that saw an increase of 104% in crime, according to Q13. Was safety the number one priority for Licton Springs?
So Licton Springs Village, we, you know, that's a low barrier village, and that village has served, you know, several hundred people, and, you know, we had a couple of, you know, neighbors raise concerns about increases in 911 calls,
104%
and, you know,
increase,
and things like that. And then what we did is we went in and we, you know, we implemented changes such as adding cameras and lighting, mm-hmm. And really focusing on, you know, the perimeter of the village. So the residents of the village are not an issue at all. It's what's happening outside of the village that is an issue.
So like it's attracting.
So we tried to basically address those by putting those measures in place. And they have actually been very helpful. And keep in mind as well that the 911 calls that are reported, many of those calls are being made by the village staff themselves. When, you know, the residents and the neighbors are aligned on this, that they don't want to be dealing with, you know, crime and, you know, disruption,
Josh,
happening outside the village. Like they don't want that as well. So whenever they see suspicious behavior occurring, they'll be the ones making those the phone calls to staff on site.
But isn't it a valid concern that these encampments do have the tendency to bring crime to the areas?
I know that there's a perception around that with, you know, I think specifically with Licton Springs, and I don't think that is borne out. There's no direct connection. I think people are correlating that.
Are you closing Licton Springs?
Like I said, we put in these improvements in place, and it made a pretty big difference with.
But Josh, aren't you guys closing Licton Springs?
People that are loitering outside of the village. You know, there's a lot less of that happening. It has made a difference. And then I think there were issues happening along Nesbitt. Right outside the village, mm-hmm. And we basically, worked with the city, the police department, to activate that street and get more SPD, bike patrols going up and down it. And that's made a difference as well. So we're learning, whenever we set up a village, we're learning about these things. And, it's the challenge of Aurora itself. I'm actually a neighbor of that area. I live literally about a block from Woodson Springs. And it's, it's, those problems have been there, crime, drug use, prostitution, those kind of things. Those have existed
sure.
the entire 15 years that I've been there.
There's no doubt.
For many years before that.
There's no doubt, Josh,
so
that it's an area.
It was pre-existing.
Josh, there's no doubt that there was clearly some pre-existing crime. But when you look at the data, there was an increase in crime to the tune of 104%, which is obviously significant. And the concern from some folks is that this type of encampment will draw people who should not be there to the neighborhood. You make the point that it's a little bit different than certainly what we've been seeing in South Lake Union, in the sense of that's a low barrier encampment, and maybe that has something to do with it. But it feels like the South Lake Union encampment, which a lot of people were caught off guard because the city was keeping it private for a very long time, and they had made a decision to move forward with this encampment before any of the community hearings even took place, and it was announced at the second hearing that they were going to move forward with it, is that this is kind of low barrier, but you're not calling it. If someone brings heroin on site, is that a violation of the rules?
So there's no drug use allowed in community spaces in the village.
Is that what I asked?
When it comes to the tiny houses themselves, we're not going to go around and inspect each house. It is going to be a behavioral based model. So people do have to abide by the rules that are in the code of conduct. Jason, I also want to mention, since we are running short on time, that these villages have touched the lives of 1,000 people. They've made a huge improvement in their lives, and we've been able to house 350 people, have transitioned into permanent housing from the villages. So they do make a difference. This is not a permanent solution. It's an interim solution, and it allows people to get off the streets, out of the danger, isolation, and cold of homelessness, into a tiny house, working with our case managers to access treatment, access housing, employment, healthcare, and then transition into housing. So housing is the ultimate goal. Of course, we're dealing with, the scale of the crisis, the lack of affordable housing, which is the biggest crisis I think many people believe we're experiencing in the city. So that is a significant challenge. But even with
sure.
that, we've been able to transition that many people into housing.
Yeah, the problem is, Josh, that a huge portion of why we're dealing with this situation is drug addiction, right? I mean, that is something we don't talk about enough of. We seem to pretend that everyone who's living out on the street was just one missed paycheck away from landing in that position. But a lot of this is being driven by drug use. And the concern is that because you're not actually controlling for heroin or any sort of opioid, you're putting people in a position where they're not going to get better. And not only are they going to stay in that position where they're not getting treatment, you're now putting them next door to someone who maybe is going through treatment and is trying to stay away from heroin or another drug. And lo and behold, their neighbor, who you're not checking whatsoever, might have access to a drug that then gets that person re-addicted.
Yeah, but don't you think it's going to be a lot easier to help people with getting in treatment and helping people with recovering from those, from addictions or any issues that they're having, if they're actually in a tiny house community that can, turn on the heat, that can have security, that can be safe?
No, honestly, I think what helps the most, and this is for me, is treatment on demand. Treatment on demand, I think that helps the most. And I know that we have the ability to provide that, and I would rather see our money going into that. Now, with that said, it's not that I want tiny homes to fail. I don't. I was a believer in tiny homes. I think the one in South Lake Union, the position you guys put it in, the physical location, is absurd. I think it's not going to benefit the community, nor is it going to benefit the people there. I've been talking with Josh Castle. He is Lehigh's Director of Community Engagement. Lehigh Low Income Housing Institute will be managing this spot in South Lake Union. I happen to live very, very close by, so I'll be paying close attention to what happens in the neighborhood. And if it's all good news, you will certainly all hear that, because I like solutions that work. If it's bad news, I will be reporting that as well, and we'll have Josh on again to be held to account for some of the stuff that's going on, because again, we all have this shared interest in making sure that this stuff works. Josh, I appreciate you stopping by.
Thank you. Thank you, Jason.
Absolutely.
Have a good day.
Welcome back to the Jason Rand Show, live in the Online Trading Academy studio. If you're wondering why you're seeing so many prostitutes openly working in Seattle, if you talk to cops, they'll tell you exactly why. They'll tell you it's because of City Attorney Pete Holmes, who officers are complaining generally refuses to pursue charges against prostitutes. And as a result of that, you've got a lot of prostitutes coming to the Seattle area, coming from out of town, from out of state in some cases. And the cops out there with the SPD, they're feeling powerless. They don't feel like they're able to effectively go after this problem, a problem that impacts lots of people who live out in these neighborhoods, lots of businesses that have to deal with prostitutes, sex workers walking up and down the streets right in front of their businesses, scaring off customers or bringing the wrong kinds of customers. But also, it gets in the way of cops trying to help sex workers who are victims themselves. And I spoke to a cop who told me law enforcement do want to do something to combat this problem because we know it's affecting the neighborhoods. We choose not to because we know that we will not get any support from the prosecutor's office. Now, if you wander around the streets near Licton Springs Tiny Home Encampment in Seattle, just about 4 or 5 minutes north of Woodland Park Zoo, you will see at any time of day, you'll spot at least a half dozen prostitutes just hanging around.
This is true. I live right there.
Yeah. A ton. All the time.
And I drive into work at 4 a.m. So.
Yeah. And this is on Aurora, and it's around Aurora. They're everywhere. And a lot of these prostitutes are here because they know that the city won't prosecute. Now, the cops, they don't necessarily want to arrest the prostitutes. They want to go after the demand, and they want to go after the bad guys behind the prostitutes, meaning the pimps. The pimps who are not just demeaning these women, who are not just abusing these women and threatening these women, but are also dealing drugs in the neighborhood. They're not. It turns out pimps, they diversify their offerings to the neighborhoods. And the problem for cops, as I've learned, as I've talked to a whole bunch of cops in the Seattle area, they're saying, we would love to be able to use as leverage jail time, prosecution, to the prostitutes so we can get them to turn on their pimps so we can arrest the pimps who are generally nearby anyway. Because they're just waiting there in a car, waiting for the prostitutes to bring back money from their johns. But they're not able to put that kind of pressure on the pimps or on the prostitutes because they know that the claim is toothless. And we talk about, you know, how our neighborhoods are turning to what they're turning into in the Seattle area. And we know that it's going to spread. Because if you think you're going to keep the hookers solely on Aurora in North Seattle without it then getting into Edmonds, without getting into Everett and Linwood and Shoreline, or going south, getting into Renton and Puyallup, you're crazy. This stuff festers and it gets worse and worse and worse. And Pete Holmes, the city attorney, refuses to do an interview with me. Their spokesperson spoke to me, so I've got that up on my blog. But if this is of concern to you, do me a favor, text the keyword RANTZ, R-A-N-T-Z, to the number 1-800-465-8770. Text RANTZ, R-A-N-T-Z, to the number 1-800-465-8770. Let's take back Seattle. Let's stop these bad policies before they spread by highlighting these issues. So when I send you a link to my blog, please read it and then post it on your Facebook wall and your Twitter feeds and your LinkedIn accounts. Put it everywhere so we can highlight the problem and put pressure on these public officials to change what it is they're doing to our neighborhoods. Text RANTZ, R-A-N-T-Z, to 1-800-465-8770. That's the Numbetter Tax Resolution Hotline.